Coming up on Simply Superior.
We can't control what Grandma and Grandpa did, but we can control what we do.
The Twin Ports observe a solemn centennial.
None of us here were there. But we have a responsibility to control the moment that we're in.
Plus, a composer and professor shares his music with the world from his home in Solent Springs.
From a very young age, I've been producing music from sort of that contemplative perspective. And one of the things that I've written recently was actually a tune for a neighbor of mine who turned 100.
Those stories, plus the news roundup and thoughts on today's Juneteenth observance, after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and that's the music of pianist and composer Ryan Frain, written to mark the 100th birthday of an amazing local woman. We'll hear more about her and Ryan's music later in the show. First, a much more somber centennial, the observance on Monday of 100 years since the lynching in Duluth of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. The event was the most tragic day in the history of the Twin Ports, affecting Duluth and Superior to the present day. And because of the challenges of today, a plan to mark the anniversary by bringing thousands to atone at the memorial site had to be called off, at least until next year. Yet there was an observance in Duluth, bringing Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Attorney General Keith Ellison. Here are their remarks.
Thank you all for coming today. It is a solemn day. It's one that I don't think things happen by chance, where things come together and we're aligned. This community has been working to tell this story and in reconciliation for an awful long time. I had the privilege of traveling with my teenage daughter today, and she mentioned how they, being a graduate of Minnesota High School, we're very proud of that, but she didn't hear this story in her classroom at any time. And this is a story of who we are. Without this story, and as I said Friday, without the connection to Mr. Clayton, Mr. Jackson, Mr. McGee, and Max Mason, it's easy then not to see that there's a direct line that descends down for 100 years to George Floyd laying on the streets in 38th in Chicago. And the inability to face the systemic issues of racism, of inequalities, of educational attainment gaps, of home ownership gaps, of healthcare gaps, and to be very Minnesotan about it and just not really want to talk about it because it's a painful conversation. I want to be here to say thank you to this community for not going in that direction and having that healing conversation, creating that space down there that after the murder of George Floyd, that space was probably needed more than anything in this city. And that is because of the vision of people who understood that. So I can tell you that Friday's historic hearing on a posthumous pardon of Max Mason was many years in the making. And in fact, we set the timing of it for Friday back in December. And since that time between COVID-19, the murder of George Floyd, the civil unrest and what we've seen in Minneapolis and the soul searching that not just us as a state, but as a nation and a world have been doing happened for a reason. And a lot of that comes back to this point, comes back to the city of Duluth, a great city, one leading on so many fronts and one that is leading on the idea that before you can have healing and movement forward, you have to have truth and reconciliation. I say that as someone who has also seen this from the pain suffered in the genocide of our indigenous communities, because every December 26th, I would take my daughter down to Reconciliation Park on Riverfront Drive, where 38 Dakota men and boys were executed in the nation's largest mass execution. Those stories inform who we are today. So I am just grateful for the invitation to be here. I am humbled to stand amongst the founders that were down there today, and to hear the stories of everything about how the statues were made and the looking across that corner to that street post, to starting at the police station, but then to ending upstairs, as the mayor said, a very visceral and painful conversation, one that many times came back to, we need white men to stand up and tell the story. We need to bear witness to what's happening. And a community that's tired of being asked to fix problems that weren't their problem, that were thrust upon them. And I heard that fatigue. I heard the pain in a mother's voice, worried about her 15-year-old. But I heard that sense of promise that we're going to be defined, whether you like it or not, we are going to be defined either by the murder of George Floyd or by how we respond to the murder of George Floyd. And if we choose to respond in a manner that this community decided on the healing that happened down at that memorial, if we choose to make the structural changes necessary, certainly on how we do policing, but how we teach our children, how we value wealth and the ability to make sure that there is a sense of fairness that goes into how we acquire that, how we cannot accept that Minnesotans are doing right, trying to do everything in by COVID-19, but here and across the nation, your chance of getting this virus and your chance of becoming ill or dying by it are much greater if your skin is brown or black. That is simply unacceptable. And the idea that in Minnesota, that I can tell you with great accuracy, the educational attainment level, the wealth level, and how long someone will live. If I walk down to that hospital and there's two babies born today and one is white and one is brown or black, I can tell you the difference today with great accuracy because of the structures we put in place. So I'm here to make that commitment along with the legislators in a manner that transcends politics but gets to the heart of the things that can really bring out the best that we have.
100 years ago, 10,003 people gathered. They didn't gather in peace. They didn't gather in love. They didn't gather to lift up our shared humanity. And they didn't gather because they were seeking justice. They gathered to murder three people: Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. None of us here were there. But it's possible that some of our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were there. We can't control what they do. We can't control what they did. Whether you are the descendant of Clayton, Jackson, or McGee, or the crowd, none of us can control that. But we have a responsibility to control the moment that we're in and stand for justice, righteousness, and truth in our time. We can't control what grandma and grandpa did, but we can control what we do. And the words of the people who framed this country, that all men, I'll say people, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those words, when they were written, they were not true yet. They were not true when Clayton, Jackson, McGee were ruthlessly, brutally murdered. But you know, we have a chance in our lifetime to make them true if we will dedicate ourselves to doing some hard work, some difficult work. Is there anybody here today who witnessed the videotape of the black man bird watching in Central Park, but who then a white woman said, "I'm going to say that you, a black man, were trying to threaten my life"? Did anybody see that?
I seen it.
She was the one violating the leash law in the park. He was the one saying, "Please obey the leash law in the park. I'm trying to look at birds and your dog running around is scaring them away." Her reaction was not, "Oh, you're right." Her reaction was, "I'm going to use my racial privilege to get you killed." What would have happened if the wrong officer showed up and responded to her call to that Blackbird watcher.
We got killed.
Much conversation is going on around policing today, and it should. But the police are a microcosm of our society. And the jurors who sat on the Rodney King verdict, which acquitted those officers from beating him 57 times, were members of our society. We can't just say the police. We gotta reform the police. We gotta completely transform the police. But we can't think we're gonna stop there and have a just society, because those officers are made up, I come from our society. And the people who are recruited and will join those police departments, if they carry the same attitudes that are alive in our society, will carry out that same oppression that we saw with George Floyd and Sandra Bland and Walter Scott and Philando Castile and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice, and the list goes on.
Trayvon Martin.
Let me just tell you this. You may think that this is a matter of mean police doing mean things to people. This is a social disease buried deep in the core of our society. It was there in the beginning. We're standing on the land of the indigenous people. We're not standing on land that is ours, really. This land was held by people for thousands of years until it was brutally and violently taken from them. And then other people were kidnapped in Africa and made to work for free for 250 years to bring wealth. And 100 years after that, we're in second-class citizenship. And it was during that period in which Clayton, Jackson, and McGee were murdered. It was during that period where the point was not that you did anything to Irene Tuscan, but we just need you to know that in this society, you better walk in fear all the time. That was the point. Cruelty and fear were the point. They didn't care about Irene Tuscan. If somebody would have sat down and said, look here, dear, we just really need to know what happened, you know she would have been able to say nothing really happened. But the men who wanted to murder and kill put so much pressure on her that she was swept away by circumstances. I'm not making excuses. She had a moral obligation to tell the truth, and she didn't. I am saying that when you mix great white supremacy and patriarchy, you can end up with a situation like this, where people will kill black men to protect white womanhood without really asking white women anything about it. Exactly. It is important to understand the intersectionality of this problem and how all these systems of oppression are wrong and must be dismantled. Yeah. Let me wrap up by saying this. I just want to wrap up by saying two quick things, because I hate it when politicians go on so long. Two quick things. One is that Clayton, Jackson, and McGee were murdered. We know the story there. But you may not know the story of Max Mason. Max Mason, after this murder, was charged with the rape of Irene Tuscan, a crime he never committed. He went to trial and was convicted and went to prison. And when he asked for a pardon, the county attorney who prosecuted him said, I don't really think he did it. Let me just put that to you again. The prosecutor who said, I'm gonna try you for rape, turned around and said, I don't really think they did it. He was hoping that the jury would just let him off. He passed the buck. I'm proud that your county attorney, Mark Rubin, said, I support the complete and total pardon of Max Mason, which we did just last Friday. The judge who presided over the case said, I don't think if he was a white person, he would have been convicted. The judge said that and wrote a letter to the pardon board saying, please fix this. He could have dismissed the case, but he passed the buck, hoping that the Minnesota Supreme Court would fix it. They didn't fix it. One courageous judge wrote a stunning dissent on how wrong the conviction was. If he'd had one or two more people to join him, the conviction might have been overturned. He didn't get them. And so Max Mason went and did about 3-4 more years in prison, which is actually a good thing because he was given about 30 years. Finally, he was allowed to leave. He said, if we'll give you a commutation of your sentence, if you leave the state of Minnesota. And so he said, I can get out. They said, yeah, I'm out. But he died never having been pardoned. As of last Friday, he was pardoned, and Max Mason's name and honor were restored by the pardon board.
Those were the remarks of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Attorney General Keith Ellison in Duluth for the 100th anniversary of the lynching of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. Coming up, Ryan Frayne and his music after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Ryan Frayne is professor of jazz studies and piano at the University of Minnesota Duluth, where he oversees the jazz studies major and program. He coordinates the annual Head of the Lakes Jazz Festival at UMD, drawing internationally known artists to the area, and in turn performs internationally himself. And closer to home, he's performed with the Green Bay Packers Band and our own local big-time jazz orchestra and scores of other venues, when there's no coronavirus going on. But there is, so he joins us by phone from his home in Solon Springs. Welcome to Simply Superior, Ryan.
Well, thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So since you are at home, are you taking advantage of this as an opportunity perhaps to compose?
Well, that's actually an insightful question because I have been. Not only are we getting our two kids through their school year, you know, we have a 7 and a 10-year-old at home, and we're both teachers, my wife and I, but it has allowed me some time to be a little bit closer to the piano, just to sit down and do a little writing. So I've been writing a bunch of new material, and that part of this has been kind of a nice change.
And I'm wondering if this is more contemplative work, since, you know, we have plenty of time to contemplate. Or are you imagining those world travels that you're not going on at the moment?
Yeah, definitely more contemplative. I'd say from a very young age, I've been producing music from sort of that contemplative perspective. And one of the things that I've written recently was actually a tune for a neighbor of mine who turned 100. And turns out she was a really great working, jobbing piano player. Dorothy Bouchard turned 100. And actually, there was an article in the paper about this back in February and March. And so I finally got around to writing her tune called Dorothy's Tune. And the story is kind of funny because we had moved into our current house about 6 years ago. And a couple of years after that, these people were moving in next door, and I saw a grand piano getting moved into this house down the street in Solon.
You would notice something like that.
I would. And of course, the neighbors, new neighbors, came walking by one day, and Roy says to me, you know, how are you? My name's Roy. And he says, yeah, well, we moved down here in part because my mother-in-law is moving in with us. I said, oh, cool. And he goes all on and on about her being this wonderful musician and piano player, and I had known that there was a grand piano moving in there. And he gets through with telling me all about her, and she must have been the workingest piano player in the Twin Ports for many, many years. And he gets to the end of the conversation and says, well, what do you do? It was a really funny, great conversation. So Dorothy and I have become friends as much as we can, although we haven't been able to visit the last few months, keeping everyone safe. So anyhow, I had the opportunity to write this tune for her and honor her 100th birthday. So I tried to think about the types of music that I've heard her play and that we've played together, and think about ways that I've heard other people explain her, such as one of my musician friends who knew her and said, classy woman.
All right, let's take a listen.
Thank you.
And that was Dorothy's Tomb by our guest, Ryan Frayne, who is speaking to us from his home in Solon Springs. One of your more contemplative works, and another one that I know pretty well. In fact, I know very well because I've been, you were gracious enough to let us use it in our documentary, The Alabama 35. And as a producer, I got to cut it, edit it, and edit it again, and edit it again. Nothing wrong with the piece. It was making it fit in the show, of course. So I know it very well, and of course, it was a joy to use. It really did set the mood for the piece. I'm doing all the talking. I'm setting it up. Let's listen to it.
Thank you.
And that was a movement from Four Improvisations by our guest, Ryan Frayne. So that's your contemplative side, but that's not your only side, right?
Well, that's right. The record that track is off of is called People We Know. And the funny part about those four improvisations is that they're the only pieces on that recording that weren't written for specific people. It was more of an in-the-moment recording than the other things on that record.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, whether it's playing, you know, bebop-type concerts with local jazz musicians or at regional festivals, or recording pop records in the Twin Cities and beyond, we get called to do a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. You have a recording of a song that you said was written for September 11th, and yet I found it to be a bit boisterous. What's the thinking behind that?
So like many people, I remember the hours after September 11th, and I think it's the only time in my life I felt like I didn't hear music. And after some time had passed, I kind of thought about writing this tune, and there are a bunch of things that relate the tune to the event. One is to try to capture, for me, my entire sort of collection of feelings, you know, the heartache, the resurrection, the loss, the rebuilding. You know, is trying to figure out how to manifest that through music. And so there are a variety of things that kind of draw this tune into that world. And one is that it uses a lot of minor 11 chords. But secondly, then thinking about the groove and the tempo had something to do with that. And it is a standard jazz form. The A sections of the tune are actually minor blues based on the minor 11 chords. And then it has a bridge. And so I was trying to use those two pieces. The bridge definitely is the more, you know, rebuilding or resurrecting or rising from the ashes kind of sound. And then the A sections are kind of the, you know, despair of the actual event.
Mm-hmm. How long after September 11th did you write it?
You know, it was longer than a month and shorter than a year after. I don't remember specifically, but it was within the year. And I'll tell you what, you know, for me, you know, I don't see something today and then write about it tonight. You know, that stuff has to kind of, you know, bubble up to the top over more thought or more experience or more consideration than an hour or a day's worth. And then at some point, it's almost automatic. You know, you just go, oh, boy, that's the tune for that day or that's the tune for that person. And it just kind of flows out.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's take a listen to 11 by Ryan Frayne. Thank you. And that was 11 by our guest, Ryan Frayne, a jazz musician, jazz pianist, and professor of jazz studies and piano at the University of Minnesota Duluth, speaking to us from his home in Solon Springs. I'm wondering, going back to teaching, by the way, in your setup for 11, you gave us a very good jazz lesson, so thank you very much. We got our tuition's worth there. So, how do you teach remotely?
Well, that's a great question, and that's one that I asked myself about March 9th. Yeah, and along with so many other people, we tried to put together the best possible solution we could for the time being, right? And what I found, of course, is first having to set up a studio at home that would accomplish that reasonably well, and something where I could communicate and hear students perform and talk with them and also make sure that they had access to things that, you know, normally we don't have the time to deal with. So, of course, the challenge of doing music remotely, you know, there are things that you cannot overcome. Ensemble playing doesn't work real well remotely. Communicating, in the moment as improvisers do, doesn't work real well remotely. However, what my students learned in terms of how to produce music virtually was really something that we don't normally spend enough time on. You know, how to arrange the gear in a way that enables you to produce something that you can publish on the internet. So, you know, people find a way. In the fall, we're looking ahead to, again, for big bands, we're going to be producing some virtual performances. And, of course, you know, looking forward to all getting back together at some point. But this is going to help us in some ways. It's not all bad news.
Great. We're speaking again with Ryan Frayne, professor of jazz studies and piano at the University of Minnesota Duluth, speaking to us from his home in Solon Springs. I want to go back to a solo. You have a recording called Anthem. We're going to not hear all of it, but I think it will recapitulate a little bit later in the show. And it will be a familiar anthem to people. We won't tell them which one it is. But the okay, you got to be playing it in minor keys. I know that much, right? I mean, it doesn't sound like it normally does.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, it sounds like we don't want to give too much away, but there's a thing that jazz players do called reharmonizations. And it's basically restructuring the harmony under the melody of a tune. This is another one of those that, for me, many people are, I know they get frustrated when they hear this particular tune reharmonized or changed in any way, because they feel that it's not, you know, paying homage to the original tune. However, I will let you know that I did this with the utmost respect and tried to reflect a lot of things about
what it stands for, right?
Yes, yeah. The ups and downs of our current situation. And I just kind of threw up a microphone and recorded this last night for your show. But it's not necessarily in a minor key, but everything is reharmonized.
All right. Thank you, Ryan Frayne, for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Robin. I certainly appreciate the call and love talking with you anytime we get a chance.
And you're welcome anytime. You can find Ryan's music at ryanfrayne.com. That's ryanfrayne.com. Here's the beginning of Anthem, and this is Simply Superior. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, our main stories continue to be around the death of George Floyd and COVID-19. But there's some developments in tribal governments about the virus, I understand.
Yeah, when the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's stay-at-home order, a lot of tribes in Wisconsin maintained or extended their own stay-at-home rulings or travel and curfew restrictions following that. And now we're seeing tribes begin to lift or loosen those restrictions. And as they're doing that, they're starting to reopen their casinos. Tribes primarily use gaming revenues from their casinos to support essential government operations or programs like healthcare and education. And, you know, they're taking precautions like many other businesses in the state have done since that ruling came about. Some of the things that they're doing at their gaming facilities include temperature screenings when people enter. Some of them are requiring masks for everyone who visits or stays there. And they're also limiting capacity and changing floor plans to allow for social distancing. Although some facilities here in northern Wisconsin still haven't opened yet as of Thursday, which would be the Red Cliff Legendary Waters Resort and Casino. Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson said they're still working on plans to make sure that people are safe once they return to the casino.
All right. And something not COVID-related but potentially affecting all of us who breathe the air is also going on with the electric companies in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Wisconsin utilities are expected to cut carbon emissions by nearly 40% in the next 6 years, and that's according to a draft strategic energy assessment that was put together by the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. It was released for public comment earlier this month, and basically the details of that report show that many of the state's largest utilities are on track to cut carbon emissions from 2005 levels by 40% by 2030. And so this would put them ahead of schedule or on track to meet those goals. Although one of the goals that's been set in the last year by Governor Tony Evers is that utilities would provide 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. And many of them are still saying that they're around the 80% target for right now, except for Minneapolis-based Xcel Energy. So there is some criticism among environmental groups who would like to see utilities pick up the slack or take more steps to speed up retirements of coal plants or their transition to renewable energy.
Mm-hmm. And Brooks, on the Minnesota side of the Bay, there's also some clean energy movement going on with power companies, correct?
That's right. Minnesota Power announced this week it's going to triple its solar power capacity with three new solar arrays around northern Minnesota. Already, the utility based in Duluth is on track to get half of its electricity from renewable sources by the end of the year. And these projects were sped up from 2025 to 2021 in order to help folks get back to work amid the COVID-19 crisis, something state regulators asked them to look at. So they'll be adding about 20 megawatts of solar power on top of the 10 megawatts they already have near Brainerd.
All right, so while we're looking at those cleaner skies, perhaps we may see some more smaller planes and ones that aren't coming from Duluth International Airport. Brooks?
That's right, Robin. Duluth Sky Harbor Regional Airport out on Park Point has reopened with a new runway that's been realigned so that it doesn't run into an old-growth pine forest on the end of Park Point. It's on 7 acres of new land built up alongside Park Point, and it officially opened last week. The $13 million project still has some remediation work with the vegetation, but for the most part, it is complete after 3 years of construction and more than a decade of planning.
All right. And in city government in Duluth, there's some changes in titles?
Yeah, this week city leaders announced they want to take the word chief from job titles, saying the term is offensive to indigenous people. They're going to start with chief administrative officer and chief financial officer by changing those titles to city administrator and finance director, respectively. As for police chief and fire chief, that is still up in the air. And they're going to have conversations about what those titles might turn into over time.
All right. Well, I suspect that won't just be Duluth that's affected by that. We've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And you can read these stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. We've also been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And finally, today is June 19th and also Juneteenth, commemorated as the day African Americans in Galveston, Texas learn, quite belatedly, that they had been freed from slavery months before with the surrender of the Confederacy that April. It was also 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth today is observed across the country as a celebration of freedom, but I've had bittersweet feelings about it. That our ancestors were freed from slavery is wonderful, but that they spent a bonus round in bondage because no one bothered to tell them the news is horrible, cynical, sad. My more personal experience for more than a decade is with the Twin Ports African American Men's Group. Every year, we cook and serve more than 400 free meals at the public commemoration of the day. We're there to give back, especially to the less fortunate among us, and there are many who are most noticeable those years when the day is marred by rain or unseasonable cold. When people are waiting in line on days like that for a half hour or more, it's a good chance it's because it's the best meal they'll get that day. The meal is free, and the volunteering isn't easy, but the thank yous we get in return are payment enough. It's also a fun day, of course, with singing groups, face painting, and a bouncy castle. Who doesn't like that? Yet I'm still haunted by the origin of the day. A celebration of freedom, yes, but only on that day because of the greed and inhumanity of those who didn't bother to tell a people that they were free. And it wasn't the first time. Right in Minnesota, as far north as you can get, Dred Scott spent the summer with his so-called master, only to be told by others when he returned to Missouri, "Hey, did you know you were free when you were up there?" That's what the whole case was about. Look it up. This year, things are different because of another black man in Minnesota who was denied his freedom, meaning his life. With the death of George Floyd and the ongoing COVID-19 crisis, our usual Juneteenth plans were scrapped, along with the bouncy castle. Though I'm sure celebrations are happening elsewhere, and I hope everyone who does celebrate has fun. Maybe with the new normal, Juneteenth will change too. If the new call for finally ending racism once and for all truly takes hold, it really will be something to celebrate, a day when freedom really does mean free. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.